Our next speaker is Paul Hazlett from Canadian Forest Service. Paul?
Thanks a lot, Ivan, and thank you, Ivan and Tom, for organizing this symposium and the invitation to present here. My co-authors on this presentation are Dave Morris, who's here. He's with the provincial government, the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources, and Rob Fleming and myself are with the Canadian Forest Service, the federal government. What I'm going to talk about today, because we're trying to identify sort of regional areas in this symposium, I'm going to give everybody a bit of a primer on the Canadian boreal forest, and also what's been going on in the forest industry in Canada for the last 10 years or so, including some of the policy incentives for bioenergy projects. And I'm going to look at some of the LTSP work that we've done in Ontario, similar to what Rob did, some of the lessons that we've learned in that, and how that's helped us develop new conceptual thinking around where we go around the biomass question. And so building on that, we're developing new boreal biomass harvesting initiatives in our region to look at biomass energy questions, and then some other initiatives and some other future directions that we're involved in. So for those of you that don't know about the boreal forest or haven't had the chance to be there, it's a light green on this forest region's map of Canada. Huge area, 310 million hectares. It spans 7 out of 10 Canadian provinces, 2 of the 3 territories, and you can see the other stats there. 520 forestry-dependent communities, which basically means up to 30% of the economy of those communities depends entirely on forestry. Probably other than hockey, probably the boreal forest is what identifies us in Canada to our neighbors and to ourselves, I guess. Take a look at the Canadian forest industry, and Rob talked a little bit about exports of Canadian lumber to the U.S., but I can tell you the housing crisis in the U.S. has had a huge impact on the Canadian forest industry. So in the last 7 years, these are some of the stats, 40% loss of direct jobs, 150,000 industry employees out of work, and that includes both on the lumber and the paper side. So in addition to the decrease in export of lumber, we've also got the question that less people are reading newspapers and magazines, so there's been a decrease in that area as well. And again, to look at the community impact and the people impact, we're talking about 340 mill closures, that's countrywide, and a 20% decrease in the capacity. And just in Ontario, looking at the stats there, we see a decrease in actual logging companies going from 1,200 down to 700. And what this has meant in some of those communities is actually the community totally shutting down, ones that were more than 30% dependent on forestry. The towns are ghost towns, really. All that in about the last 7 years. So we've had some presentations so far that talked about, you know, the benefits of bioenergy in terms of looking at mitigating climate change, becoming less dependent on fossil fuels. What the picture in the industry points to is the fact that in Canada, governments have also been engaged to try and reinvigorate the forest industry through bioenergy development. So at the federal level, the Canadian government has looked at several programs to try and inject capital into the bioenergy industry. And sort of in two ways, one of them is with direct subsidies to firms that are looking at developing technologies, and the other one is through policies and legislation that would encourage companies to move to more green energy. So the first one I have here that I've looked at here is eco-energy for renewable power. So this is sort of the direct subsidies, either in R&D or in actual implementation of technology to get more clean electricity, including biomass as well as other sources. There's one specifically in eco-energy for biofuels, so trying to expand the use of cleaner, more renewable biofuels. And then a fuel standard. So this is one where putting a piece of legislation in place which will cause stimulation in the bioenergy industry through at least having 5% renewable fuel content by 2010. not sure if we're there yet, to tell you the truth. And then in Ontario, in our provincial situation, we've also got some policy drivers. Most of them are actually legislation, not direct subsidies, but legislation put in place to push industries more into looking at green energy. First one is the Green Energy Act. So it's a feed-in tariff system that guarantees specific rates for energy generated from renewals. And this was quite an issue in our election because right now the government is paying really high prices for people to feed in biomass energy, solar and wind, much more than we're actually paying for that energy. Yeah. The party that put this platform forward actually won the election very narrowly over others that were fighting against it. I can't remember, somebody might have mentioned this yesterday, but I think Jim did, Jim McLaughlin, but there's also a move to get out of coal-fired electricity in the province of Ontario, which is again a stimulus to more biomass energy. And then there's also discussions right now about a cap and trade system. Ontario's having discussions with several states and other provinces, and in the end, this would bring forward renewable energy credits. So again, a stimulus to get into renewable energy. And the last one, another one around fuel, a low-carbon fuel standard to reduce life cycle carbon of transportation fuels. So all of these, from both sides of the story, from the point of view of what's happening to the forest industry, from the point of view of the incentives, there's a real move out there, at least I'll say a move, I won't say it's happened, to take residue materials from logging sites, either stumps or coarse woody debris, as well as material that's burned now as well, as Rob suggested, that's taken off-site and burned, to turn that into some kind of bioenergy. And I think one of the, what we find is one of the interesting things about this debate is that in this case we have done a really good job in terms of educating the public over the last 40 or 50 years, I think, Dale, about the valuable role that this kind of material plays in terms of future soil productivity, biodiversity, and so on. Because what we find is when we talk to people, when we talk to people in policy, the first thing they want to know is, well, can we really take that without it being a problem? Because we think it's going to be a problem. So I'm sure most of you have the same experience. Intuitively, when you talk to people, they think, well, that can't be really good to take all that material off site. So it's what's happened is that's trickled down to us to, as we're all finding, to answer these questions about how much do we take, how much do we leave. And I think that's the question a lot of us are struggling with. So I'm going to present some material now on our LTSP studies that are circled there up in northwestern Ontario. Those are Dave Morris's sites, slightly down northeastern Ontario, the east end of Lake Superior. Those are the sites Rob Fleming and I have been working on for a few years. And take a look at some of those results. I think it's worth pointing out, it's repeating a bit of what Rob said, but one of the key variables within the LTSP, within the conceptual model, is that organic matter is a major variable regulating soil processes that affect productivity. Interestingly enough, when I'm talking to my directors about this piece of work, and we're actually in year 18 after harvest now at our sites, and we're talking about this new issue of bioenergy, and I say, well, we've got a project that's now 18 years old and feeds into that, and then they say, well, that's a productivity product. That's got nothing to do with bioenergy. So I throw up this slide and say, yeah, but one of the major factors, one of the major variables in this study was to remove different amounts of organic matter. What's the difference between that and bioenergy, right? So again, I'll show you in a minute, but we do some modifications of site organic matter. That's a main treatment effect within the design. And again, not to, I have to point this out because it's so important in this discussion. What we're doing at these sites is long-term forest growth measurements. Okay, we're not just looking 5 years after harvest, we're looking long term. And again, that's one of the big questions about bioenergy. What's the impact 5 years? What's the impact at next rotation? So that's really important. And the other point I want to make here is that on our sites and all the LTSP sites, we've done very accurate measurements of pre- and post-harvest pools. And you saw Rob show an example there that give us an opportunity to give an accurate depiction of what's been removed and what's been retained on site. In addition to that, of course, we're going back and doing measurements post-harvest on what's happened to the soil pools and the stand growth and all that kind of stuff. So, this is important because when we get into this idea of identifying indicators in terms of sensitivity or suitability of sites, we have to know something before we take the material, right? We can't go back afterwards. So this material really comes in handy. So in our Ontario LTSP, we targeted what we thought would be sites that would be susceptible to productivity declines, dare I say bioenergy harvest, organic matter removal at this time, which includes coarse textured sites, low cation exchange, low carbon soils, coarse textured soils, and also shallow to bedrock soils. So some of the data I'm going to present here, we're looking at jackpine sites, site index gradient from 14 to 21 meters at age 50. And again, those span across the sites. So we've got 14 sites that were harvested in 1993 to 1995. These were all mature fire origin sites, so 60 to 125-year-old stands. And we've got the three different treatments. We've got a tree length treatment. If you're used to the LTSP, that's the OM0 treatment. A full tree harvest, OM1, and a full tree harvest plus forest floor removal, so the OM2. And at the 14 sites, the treatments are replicated three times on 30 meter by 30 meter plots. So this is what an example of what the sites look like after harvest. On the top left, you've got the stem only, the OM0 full tree on the top right, and a complete forest floor removal down on the bottom. Quite dramatic organic removal treatment. So what we've learned, what have we learned in terms of these Ontario LTSP studies? Well, probably one of the most important things in support of doing this work long term is that the constraints on stand development change over time. So if you take a look at the top graph, you've got the dotted line of a biomass increment increasing rapidly in the stand initiation phase. But what you find on the bottom graph shows that really, again, the dashed line is soil nutrients. The contribution of stand nutrients as a constraint are not very large in that stand initiation stage. More important during that time is the red line on the bottom, which shows microclimate and the importance of that. So when we went into our sites within the first 10 years after harvesting, what we found is the trees that were on those bladed plots were actually outperforming the ones that were on the ones where we left greater amount of woody material. And again, that's because the stand at that time wasn't demanding nutrients from the site to the same extent. So again, it's important to have this your site in context of this development over time to look at the impact of nutrient removal. Obviously, a lot of things are affecting productivity, but at different amounts over the development of the stand. We've done, so now the results I'm going to present for the next couple of slides will be looking at the nutrient pools just after the harvest and looking at some indices similar to what Rob presented by Evans of depletion or retention of material on site. And then in a few minutes, I'm going to present some of the results after year 15. So it's important to keep that in the context of the previous slide of where we are in terms of the stand development, which is just about at CC canopy closure, which showed there. So what we're looking at here is in what I've called in this case is the sensitivity index. It's really the same thing Rob talked about, which just is a ratio of the amount of element removed versus the pre-harvest site content. And I've got up here for carbon, nitrogen, calcium, and magnesium. And again, we've got 14 sites across each plot, and it shows the three different treatments that we talked about. So the tree length, the full tree, and the forest floor removal. And I think that the main thing I want you to take away from this slide is that there's several contradictory interpretations with this kind of approach. Looking at carbon and nitrogen, our interpretation of these kind of graphs and significant regressions is that there's a greater sensitivity on the lower productivity sites. More material is removed on those sites. But if you look at different elements, you don't see patterns. If you look at different treatments, such as the tree length and the full tree for the carbon in the upper left here, without a couple of points here, you might get an opposite interpretation, that things are more sensitive on the higher site productivity. So site index down here, sorry, I should have pointed that out. If you look at some other indicators like nutrient replacement times, how much nutrient is removed, how much is it, how long is it, does it take to replace that, either through precipitation or weathering, combination of those things, again, we might come up with contradictory interpretations. In fact, we do in lots of cases come up with the opposite interpretations of what we found here. So we got rolling this over in our mind, Dave and Rob and I, we thought, well, I mean, retention or removals is one thing, but maybe retention is a more important thing. So we started to look at how much of the nutrients were actually retained on site after harvest. I mean, that's what the new forest is seeing. It's not seeing how much you're taking away. It's seeing how much you're leaving there. So in this case, I should point out, too, I mean, other things, other factors are obviously involved in these responses to growth. So in this case, we're looking at growth intercept here, which is really a height measurement from the year to 10 to 15 on the y-axis. On the x-axis, we've got the post-harvest reserves of carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium again. And this value of post-harvest reserve includes the forest floor, the top 20 centimeters of mineral soil, and any coarse woody debris that was left on site after harvest. And I guess the other point that I was trying to make here was the fact that there are other factors involved in looking at this response, this productivity response. In this case, we separate out the sites by texture. So we have some sites that are slightly, of our 14, that are slightly more finer textured sites. And we've, I guess we've classified them over 50% silt. So they're more in the silt loam category. And those are the open symbols here for each of the different treatments again, so you can see the three different treatments. But the important thing, again, to take away from this one is we see a much a better relationship versus some of those other indicators that we use to define sensitivity using the reserves left on site. In the case of looking at carbon, we can see a good a gradient of growth increase with greater amount of carbon retained on site until some kind of a threshold where things drop off. And we think this is related more to the physical condition of having a really thick forest floor on the site that's giving less growth over that time period. But you can also see here for, and this one shows it the best for the potassium, you can see this kind of relationship also for the silt loam as well as for the sandy loam, the coarser textured soil. So this gives us, we're still thinking about how we translate this into sensitivity or a suitability of site, but it gives us, especially the carbon one, some idea of how we might be able to translate carbon retained onto a site rather than carbon removed from a site to be able to predict productivity on these sites post-harvest. And if you take a look at, without these really thick forest floor sites, you see that we've got about a 35% decline over the sites with thin forest floors here. So every 25 tons of carbon we remove, we cause a 10% decrease in growth. Just to break that down a little bit more and say, okay, why are we seeing that relationship with carbon? We looked at specifically pre-harvest forest floor carbon, the forest floor plus any post-harvest residues, and then the post-harvest site mineral soil carbon. And you can see really good relationships with mineral soil carbon. In this case, we've taken out the forest floor removal treatment because it obviously wouldn't have any forest floor on it. But when you come, this is the previous slide showed the sum total of these three effects. So we do see a separation when we add in the post-harvest residues of these treatments versus just the forest floor carbon on site. So this raised the question for us, does a productivity gradient like we have here, does that provide a proxy for a more intensive range of biomass removals from any particular site? And I don't have the answer to that. It's a question that we're kind of wrestling with. So some of the limitations to this approach that we've used so far, we've got a limited type of site. We've got one site type here, an infertile jack pine forest. We might find some of the other indices have a wider range for different site types across the province, mixed woods, peatlands, that sort of thing. Really, some of the nutrient budget indicators in the post-harvest reserves, they don't really account for nutrient availability or demand on the site. So in some ways, you might wonder, is it just good luck that it's working out here with some of these total assessments of nutrient pools on site? And again, the whole idea of stand development. This data is from 15 years. Will there be more separation of these treatments as we go forward and there's a greater demand on the site? So building on that experience, we've designed some new bioenergy experiments, and we're looking at different types of different ranges of biofiber removal. So, and this is where we've gone with this. We have the tree length that we utilized in the LTSP, but now we're looking at a full tree biomass harvest, and these are photos from last winter where we're actually removing from the site wood to feed cogeneration plants. So small diameters, other trees that were unmerchable in the past that we are now being harvested for bioenergy. And then we've got a full tree stumped treatment on this new experiment. So we're actually stumping the site. We're not actually using this for bioenergy, but it's being done elsewhere. We're removing that from the site and then down to our full tree forest floor removal again. The other thing we're trying to build into the new experiment is an examination of what we're calling the biological legacy effect. So looking at the second growth idea that Dale presented, looking at mid-rotation stands, poorly generated stands that have a potential for site improvement, but don't have as much coarse woody debris on the forest floor. So this is a mature fire origin stand. Here's a plantation without that biological legacy. So our question is, when you go in and harvest this kind of site, as Dale proposed, what's the difference going to be in terms of productivity response? So just to put that all within sort of a framework, a response function, these are what we have out of our LTSP experiment now. We've got first rotation, stem only and full tree, not much difference. The bladed productivity way down here. And in some ways at any particular site, we don't know what's going on in terms of a productivity or biodiversity response for the amount retained on site of any particular nutrient. So with the new experiment where we're looking at a stem-only harvest, a full tree harvest, and a forest floor removal within a second rotation without that biological legacy, and again, these are hypothesized bars, and this is when we have the first rotation and the second rotation, full tree removal with the stumps. So our hope with this is that we can build some kind of a threshold level of retention that we could suggest to managers. When you go past this point in terms of what you're retaining on site, this is where you can expect to see a breakpoint, or it may end up being a straight line down. That's what we're trying to find out. The other thing we're really excited about is with the new study, we're looking at the impact of biomass harvesting on biodiversity. And we're really happy within our group to have three very young female scientists that have just joined the Canadian Forest Service within the last 5 years. Isabelle Aubin, who's a vegetation ecologist, Lisa Vernier, a wildlife ecologist, and Kara Webster, a soil ecologist, that are going to look at the impact of the increasing biomass removal on a multi-trophic approach to looking at that. And the way they're going to look at it is at all these different levels, but also with the idea of looking at a trait-based approach and looking at how these communities respond to a change, but also how this change affects other ecosystem processes, so how that feeds into productivity. They've challenged our thinking. Our new experiments are 70-meter by 70-meter plots instead of 30 by 30 because they need that kind of area to do the biodiversity work, but we're looking forward to doing that. And the last thing on this, we're looking more at site remediation, so incorporating wood ash waste from cogeneration and fertilization as a remediation measure. So just a few other initiatives. There is a CFS national project titled here that's led by Brian Titus, who's here today out of the Pacific Lab. And there are lots of other plots and old trials through the Energy from Forest program that was back in the 1970s and 80s across the country that we're remeasuring as part of this team. There's looking at other indicators that I've listed there rather than just the nutrients retained on site. And spatial applications. How can we map this? How can we provide a map to policymakers, land managers to take a look at where we can and where we shouldn't remove biomass? We're also associated with a federal provincial bioeconomy technical working group. And this is where we have our contact with where we have our contact with the forest managers and policy advisors. So getting a reality check to the questions they're asking and also a reality check for them for what we can actually provide in terms of research to support policies. And then the last and not least is partnerships with communities. What we find in Ontario and throughout Canada is these forest communities are more vested in the forest personally than you might think. Okay, I talked about their economic dependence in it, but they're having more of a say in what goes on in terms of the development, not just from the point of, not just the government or industry telling them, here's what we're going to do. So we're involved with one called the Northeast Superior Forest Community, which is six small communities and six First Nations on the east side of Lake Superior. And with them, we're developing experiments and demonstration areas for the public to take a look at the potential for bioenergy work. Thanks a lot for your time, and I'll take any questions.